Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, foot and mouth returns, the livestock trade reels as supply chains feel the strain. Inflation edges up, but the markets roar as the JSE smashes through 100,000 points. New equity laws make transformation non-negotiable, and a dram good time. A rare whiskey showcase hits Johannesburg and Cape Town. It's Thursday, the 24th of July. South Africa's red meat industry is under strain once again as a fresh foot and mouth disease outbreak spreads across five provinces, I understand. So export bans are piling up, market access obviously restricted, and local prices are facing volatility as supply chains start to buckle. For an industry already navigating thin margins and rising input costs, the economic risks are growing fast. And I want to discuss this and see how big a crisis it is. With me is Wandile Sihlobo, Chief Economist at Agbiz. Let's take a look at the commercial fallout and maybe what business needs to do to brace for next. Obviously, there's also an impact on you and me, consumers, and our grocery bill. So, Wandile, let's start with the impact and a warm welcome. What's the immediate economic fallout of this outbreak for commercial livestock producers? How bad is it?
I think, Jeremy, if I could just highlight, firstly, how important the livestock industry is to the farming economy, which is that if you look at the South African agricultural sector, livestock accounts for roughly half of that, which means then that whenever there are strains in the cattle industry, that you would see it over time showing across the performance of the sector. At this moment, the impact is in a few farms, not really across every other farm. But the challenge of it is that when there's a limitation on a movement of cattle, limitation in terms of the export activity, over time, we will begin to see the financial impact of that. We don't have as yet the rands and cents of what the cost is, but we know that from a farmer's side, you are having to endure a lot of costs, because remember, this disease is not killing a cattle per se, but rather you can't slaughter for a certain period and you have to be feeding these cattle, some for more than 2 months, without any much significant income coming in. So that puts a lot of burden on the production side of the cost in the farms.
And worrying that China, Zimbabwe, I think, and also Namibia are halting imports.
As a practice, whenever you have some of these diseases, you usually get a temporary restrictions on the exports. And this comes at a bad time, because you remember in some of our conversations, we had talked about South Africa's drive to open up as many export markets as we can. And the red meat industry has been amongst some of those that have actually been on this journey, to an extent that if you think about last year, we saw our exports recovering nicely after a dip that we experienced in 2020. Because of the same issue that we're seeing now. At the time, our exports collapsed by 19% in red meat and 16% in wool. We were thinking that now that we are on a recovery path, but my sense is that we'll continue to feel that economic pain for much of the second quarter in terms of the exports.
And what about locally? Would there be an oversupply of beef? Could this lead to lower consumer prices in the short term, or are input cost pressures offsetting any benefit?
I think, Jeremy, it's worth noting that the red meat and the general protein products that South Africa puts into the market are safe for consumption. The only reason we get to see the export being restricted is not so much of a safety from a human consumption side of this. It's because the disease is usually endemic to certain areas, and therefore countries take all measures to ensure that at least they are not exposed to risks of a transfer in their areas, but not on the safety of this. So in terms of the local market, we will continue to see slaughtering in areas as they clear up because the vaccination has started now. And as a result of that, we anticipate that there will be an unusual increase at a certain period in the coming months on the domestic red meat supplies. And that too then will add a bit of pressure on the red meat prices. And that will happen in an environment where the South African consumer anyway is under pressure, which means then that the demand for red meat is not as that robustly, which I think will continue to weigh financially on the producer side. And that's what I'm really worried about when we are thinking about this year and these challenges of these diseases.
And beyond that, I imagine there is also a supply chain spillover risk that would be related or impact other sectors, so feed logistics, even insurance.
We may, of course, have to look closely to say on the financing, on the financial conditions of these farms, what that means then for those businesses. But my hope is that with the vaccination having started and the great awareness that the Department of Agriculture has been doing about the foot and mouth disease and certain measures that the farmers should take, I hope that we can be able to be clear of those risks and then we don't get to be in a difficult position. But the one thing, Jeremy, that is important is vaccination. And I think we need to build the domestic capability on a vaccine manufacturing as well as vaccination across the country. It's something we have to do. It's very important.
And what exactly is the problem there? It's not the first time that vaccine supply has been cited as a failure point.
The key thing here, Jeremy, I think we haven't recovered from the state capture days and some of the mismanagement that's happened in our institutions. And one of those institutions I would argue was affected is the OBP, which is South Africa's state-owned vaccine manufacturing company, which hasn't really been producing anything. I mean, we pride ourselves, Jeremy, as being the leading agricultural producer and exporter in Africa, but we don't even have vaccine. We have to depend on Botswana. So we have to revive that. And Minister Steyn and DG Ramasodi of Agriculture are really focused on that. They spoke on that earlier this week.
But given the risk potential, is it time for the private sector to either take control or to play a bigger and more robust role?
My point would be that in the past, we had certain vaccines designated to be produced by certain entities. This time around, we have evolved from those days. Let's ensure that at least we add one or two or three private sector organizations that can have the similar licensings to producing some of these vaccines like the FMD. That way you spread your risk, but also you ensure that you have enough capacity because what we have learned is that over the recent past, the outbreak of these diseases is even more than before. It may be because of climate, these extreme weather conditions are perhaps enabling the virus to spread much faster, which is why I think that involving the private sector, even on an FMD vaccine manufacturing, will be an ideal path. And I hope that the Department of Agriculture signaling their willingness to work with the private sector is perhaps maybe a step towards such direction. It's something that I think is important for the country.
And the argument that the country should consider a permanent regional disease zoning plan to contain future economic fallout, how does that sit with you?
I mean, look, that is an important aspect. And of course, we will be guided by the scientists on what they are saying. But the other thing, Jeremy, I think as a country, we have to entertain it is the idea of should we be just taking a policy of vaccinating against FMD nationwide, not only vaccinating whenever there are suspected cases, but take a similar step as the South Americans, where we know that South Africa vaccinates. And I know I'm putting that up there. There's a scientific consideration, as well as the fact that in some of our trade deal, we may have to renegotiate certain things. But what we have learned is that in 2022-23, we were affected by this disease in about six of our nine provinces. And we continued to limp along and affected again last year in the Eastern Cape. Therefore, if it is continuing and it is with us this way, should we not consider the way of actually vaccinating as well? Which I think that along the work that is done currently around the regionalization, we have to also explore the idea of vaccination like South Americans.
So just to reiterate, in conclusion, you can give us some reassurance. Our weekend braai, rump steak and boerewors, safe for the moment?
Safe for the moment and possibly more affordable in the coming days. But think of the farmer that will be experiencing higher input costs. And the only way to support them is to go and buy that high quality meat.
Wandile Sihlobo, thank you very much indeed. Chief Economist at AgBiz.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you'll be well aware that South Africa's inflation ticking up to a four-month high, but still within the Reserve Bank's current target range. At the same time, analysts at Goldman Sachs and Investec saying today there's room for up to three interest rate cuts this year. So that's a bit of rare optimism in a complex economic climate. At the same time, the JSE hitting a historic 100,000-point milestone, fueled by strong gains in mining and tech stocks. So I need to know if this is a turning point, or if it's just a temporary lift in a structurally weak economy. What's driving the momentum? And perhaps more importantly, what risks lie ahead? And what kind of path is South Africa really on? All big questions. And let's put those to Anneke van Rooyen, who's a financial commentator and economist at the Regenesis Business School. So Anneke, let's start with the JSE. Is the surge a reflection, in your opinion, of genuine economic strength? Or is this just capitalizing on external momentum?
The short answer is no, it's not on the back of economic strength. The JSE is up 19% year-to-date in rand terms, 28% in dollar terms. And this is a tale of two stories. The split between local factors and external factors, I would favor 75% to external factors. The SA Inc. stocks remain undervalued, and they reflect the risk of tariffs and also the lackluster local economic growth outlook versus precious metal or safe haven stocks and mining stocks, which are beneficiaries of a weaker US dollar, large infrastructure projects in China, and also front loading on the back of tariffs. So we've seen global market action being dominated by those easing US-China trade tensions that has filtered through to stocks like Naspers and Prosus, because Tencent is listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, and that is a key value driver of Naspers and Prosus. And then, of course, our telcos have also re-rated because they've come from a very low base.
Now, counterpointing that is inflation, which is creeping up again. Anneke, in your opinion, should we be worried about this trend, or is this just a little bit of a blip, a little bit of noise within the current target band?
I don't think there's reason to be concerned. We're still at the lower end of the target range of the Reserve Bank. So we do expect inflation to rise to about 3.5%, and this will reflect the high utility costs and some monthly pressure on food that will unfortunately not be mitigated by fuel price deflation due to the 55 cents increase in the petrol price during July. But over the long term, inflation is expected to move towards the midpoint before turning down again, especially if a lower inflation target is introduced in South Africa.
Do you agree with the assertion that there could be room for three rate cuts this year, or maybe that's a little too optimistic?
Look, I do think there's room for another two cuts, definitely. Three might be a little bit optimistic. The outlook at the start of 2025 was for 100 basis point cuts, but that was before Liberation Day in the US, which clouded inflation expectations and resulted in elevated levels of uncertainty and central banks then pausing their rate cutting cycles. So the Fed usually sets the pace for the South African rate cutting cycle, so it'll be interesting to see what Saab is going to do, whether they'll wait for the Fed or not. But I think that they should capitalize on the low inflation environment. The key pin is that lower inflation target, whether that's going to be introduced or not.
So let's assume those rates are coming. What signal then is this sending out about the state of our economy?
If the cutting cycle resumes in South Africa, it will definitely signal the delayed start of an economic recovery, underpinned by higher disposable income and improved consumer and investor confidence.
Having said that, though, we still live in a volatile and very uncertain global environment. So, Anneke, what risks are you seeing short-term on the horizon? Is it energy? Is it fiscal slippage? Is it geopolitical uncertainty, or a combination of all of that?
Yeah, it's a combination of all of those. Headwinds can be caused by a spike in the price of oil. We all know the US has given Russia 50 days to end that war with Ukraine before they impose sanctions, not only on Russia, but also countries that buy oil from Russia. So then we also have the ongoing trade negotiations between South Africa and the US. So that can turn into a headwind if these talks are unsuccessful, as it will take time to change our export destinations. And then, of course, trade negotiations of SA's main trade partners can also cause headwinds, specifically EU and China, which haven't been finalized yet. And then most importantly, I think those sectoral tariffs that we still have to negotiate pose a threat to the South African economy in the auto and the agricultural sectors.
In spite of those headwinds, the government is talking up reform progress, notably Operation Vulindlela, SOE restructuring, but I suspect it's too soon to say whether these are having a real measurable impact just yet.
Perhaps too soon, but there are some positives reflected, you know, in the stabilization in electricity supply and also improvement in the transport and logistics sectors, which, you know, if you analyze the Transnet results, you'll see that their volumes have actually increased. We've also seen other improvements that include the downturn in the cost of mobile data, the clearing of the visa backlog, and then the second wave of reform is work in progress, but we need to see these reforms happening at a faster pace because a growing economy needs a supportive infrastructure.
And let me just ask you a final question then. I'd like you to reflect on the rand, if you can. On my screen at the moment, a little weaker today, 1761 against the US dollar. But more broadly, what's your view on the rand's relative stability at the moment? Is this a sign of more confidence or maybe just a carry trade opportunism?
No, I think there's a few factors that are underpinning the stability and the strength of the currency. And definitely, as you mentioned, one is the current the carry trade and also the high real interest rates in South Africa, but also firmer commodity prices are providing an underpin. Definitely US dollar weakness, and I don't think the dollar is out of the woods just yet. And then the GNU stability and optimism around that, and then also that possible inflation target can also provide a nice underpin. And then just optimism around South Africa being removed from the grey list in October. So I think there's more positives than negatives at this point in time.
Anneke van Rooyen from the Regenesis Business School, thank you very much indeed. At the end of November, Johannesburg will host the first G20 summit on African soil, and the world is watching. Mandates and Megaphones is a new MoneyWeb podcast hosted by me, Jeremy Maggs, unpacking the politics, promises, and the power plays behind this historic event. From debt diplomacy and climate justice to global trade tensions, infrastructure pressure, and who gets a seat at the table, I'm going to dig into the issues that really matter and the impact on business and the economy. Follow Mandates and Megaphones on MoneyWeb and wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by Standard Bank.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South African companies are now under legal obligation, not just moral pressure, to transform their workplaces. New employment equity targets, published in April and effective from 1 September, set legally binding representation goals for black people, women, and people with disabilities across 18 economic sectors. With tough penalties, tighter reporting standards, and sector-specific targets, this is a landmark moment for workplace transformation. But here's my question. Are the targets realistic in a low-growth economy such as ours? Are companies ready? And what's the bigger picture when it comes to competitiveness, ESG, and social stability? Someone who's applied his mind to that is the executive chairman of 21st Century, Maputa Diaz, who joins me now. Maputa, a very warm welcome to you. So just maybe a little bit of context, first of all, what's the biggest shift, in your opinion, in these new regulations compared to the past?
Well, the latest amendment to the Employment Equity Act provides powers to the minister to identify numerical targets in various industry sectors. And as you would appreciate, those sectors have been stacked in terms of statistics, South Africa's framework in terms of dividing the economy into various sectors. Now, what the department has done is to look at the performance of companies over time. I mean, we are now more than 20 years transforming organizations in terms of the Employment Equity Act. They have looked at specific sectors and based on that, through the NEDLAC process, identified numerical targets for each and every one of those 18 sectors. Now, whether or not those are reasonable or not remains to be seen, Jeremy. From a business point of view, we have had a careful look at those. And from a business point of view, we have looked at that from the point of view of what our role is and how we can support and assist companies in terms of achieving those targets.
All right, that's the background then. Let's be honest, though. The process has not been without its criticism, and you talk about reasonableness. And some companies are emphatically saying the targets are unachievable in a struggling low-growth economy. Do they have a point?
Well, to some extent, I would like to believe that they have a point. But as I indicated, our standpoint as a company is, well, those are given and within the context of the current economic situation and what is our role as a business to assist employees to achieve those. We must also not forget the fact that consideration has also been made in terms of how the performance has been over the past 25 years, as reported by the Commission for Employment Equity, and that has also been taken into consideration. Whether or not those are reasonable or not reasonable, I think for us as a business, it would be somewhat uncomfortable order to comment on their reasonableness or otherwise.
I suppose there's a counterpoint to this argument as well, is that many businesses might be genuinely unprepared, but others have simply dragged their feet for too long.
Yeah. If you look at particularly the SA Board for People Practices has now and then commented on the progress or otherwise. And the picture that they have put out there is one of, while there is considerable progress in certain sectors or industries, other sectors also need to improve in respect of those, particularly the top four workforce categories, and of course the employees with disabilities. Those are the areas where it is generally known that we haven't done well as a country.
I suppose there's also the risk that all of this becomes that euphemistic box-ticking exercise to avoid penalties rather than transformation. And it would be concerning that some CEOs might see this as a nice-to-have rather than a strategic priority.
Yeah, well, we believe that in terms of how the numerical targets have been set, and in terms of the requirements that have now been placed on business and the impact that it will have on businesses that are not able to perform against those targets would be dire. And we advise strongly that this should not be regarded as a tick box exercise, but a genuine transformation intervention or approach to this transformation.
What is your understanding of penalties? How aggressive do you expect the Department of Labor to be with enforcement, given that enforcement capacity is an issue within the department itself?
Well, to date, you may be aware that up to 200 employers have been brought to the Labor Court, and the penalties range from anything up to 1.5 million rand or 2% of the company's turnover. So those penalties are dire, but our viewpoint is that this should not be done as a tick box exercise, and it should not be done for merely avoiding those penalties, but it should be done as part of business's transformation and the agenda that businesses have been pursuing for the past 25 years or so. And of course, now it requires that we change the way we do we have always done things, because now we've got these targets in front of us that we need to work towards.
So you're the non-exec chair of a big organization. If you were advising a board today, what's the first thing that you would tell them to do before the 1st of September?
Well, I think as soon as possible, between now and the 1st of September, companies, we advise very strongly that companies should start putting together their workforce analysis. They must immediately conduct their workforce analysis, and not just cut and paste the previous workforce analysis. I would imagine that I would very strongly suggest that this should be an approach that they start from, as if they started from scratch, as opposed to just cutting and pasting the previous workforce analysis information they have. So let them do that. And once they have done that, then work towards a new plan in terms of for the next 5 years up to 2030. And of course, we very strongly also suggest that they do this jointly with their employment equity forums or committees, which are statutorily required for employers to jointly with those committees conduct those analyses.
Well, about 5 weeks or so to go before that 1 September deadline. Maputa Diaz, thank you very much indeed, non-executive chairman of 21st Century.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, whiskey isn't just having a moment in South Africa. It's really enjoying a boom. From everyday sipping to serious collecting, more and more South Africans are developing a taste. And leading the charge is specialist retailer Whiskey Brother, host of the Only Whiskey Show. It's an annual celebration of craftsmanship, curation, and I guess global flavor. I want to talk now to the founder and managing director, Mark Pendlebury. Mark, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the broad landscape. Whiskey, as I've mentioned, is booming in South Africa. What's driving the growth, and do you think it's sustainable?
Hi, Jeremy. Lovely to chat to you again. I mean, I think sadly, you know, whiskey is not booming anymore, not in South Africa and not globally. The industry has very much come off its COVID highs, shall we say, similar to other industries as well, which are returning to pre-COVID and 2019 levels. And so I would say, you know, there's still a thriving community. There are still many, many, you know, South African whiskey drinkers who are passionate about the products and the, you know, the history and the places, but due to just kind of pressures on their budgets, are maybe not buying as much as they were. So we're still seeing the same interest, but we're not seeing the same value.
I'm interested to know whether the South African whiskey drinker's palate is changing. Are we still Scotch loyalists, or do you think there's a little bit more geographic exploration these days?
I think that there's much more exploration amongst maybe, let's say, you know, the more interested enthusiasts. So, you know, there are many general drinkers that enjoy their whiskey, but you maybe stick to more commercial brands and don't explore as much. But I think as per any kind of community that, you know, let's say goes on a journey and takes a little bit more interest in what is in their glass and, you know, how it's made and the craftsmanship thereof, they're more likely to explore and try new things. So, you know, within the Whiskey Brother customer and fan base, we very much see lots of exploration. Whatever is new on our shelves is generally what's selling well, because people want to try the new thing or the latest release or a new producer or a new part of the world that now has whiskey on offer. I would say at a high level, at a macro level, the trends haven't changed too much. We still see very much, you know, Scotch first and foremost, then lots of Irish, and then lots of American. But those are driven by the bulk of those, you know, are driven by the commercial products that we can list quite easily that are available everywhere.
And Mark, let me pick you up on that phrase, trying new things. Tell me a little then about the Only Whiskey Show and what makes it stand apart in what I would assume is a fairly crowded market.
So I don't think it's overly crowded. You know, we started the show in 2017, very much inspired by other shows, both locally and internationally. But, you know, we know we've got a customer base and a fan base that like what we do. And so it made sense to, let's say, have a show for them. Obviously, everyone's welcome, whether you're a Whiskey Brother customer or not. But it does appeal to those that are slightly more interested in just kind of, you know, the general drinker. For us, the highlight of the show is very much around the vast selection of premium whiskeys available for tasting. This year, we should have over 160 different whiskies. They're all premium. A lot of the stuff is not generally available. We have very limited and, kind of harder to find releases. And then coupled with that is the community, which includes international guests that we bring to the show. So this year we've got four international guests that are making their way to South Africa just to attend the show. Three from Scotland, one from Ireland. And that includes, the likes of Alan Winchester, who has spent 50 years producing whiskey in Scotland, has overseen 22 different malt distilleries, is a master of the quaigh, and has been inducted into the Whiskey Hall of Fame. And he's coming to South Africa for the first time and will be at the show on the general floor, just available to mingle and talk and sign bottles, as well as then a masterclass, where we're trying some very special stuff that is not generally available.
Mark, we're talking about tasting, but what about whiskey these days as an investment? Why? And is it becoming more visible, the trend in this country?
So I think it definitely is becoming more visible. However, I would caution, and I do think that there is room to invest in whiskey, shall we say. I think like any investment, you need to know what you're doing. There are risks and people need to be aware that, maybe the bottle they're buying is not worth what they hope it to be one day. With that said, I think a lot of, whiskey enthusiasts often buy more than they can consume. Or they have an affinity for a particular brand or a particular series, and they end up collecting, maybe not intentionally, but they do. And then, the hope is that the bottles that are closed will appreciate in time and could be an investment for my kids or for later on in life. So you see a lot of almost strategically and explicitly, and then we see those that do it just, as a byproduct of their passion and of their purchasing. What I would say is that, like any luxury good, there is room for what you buy to appreciate, but it doesn't mean everything is going to be worth more. In recent years, we've seen a lot of cask investment programs, but at the moment, that feels like that pyramid to some degree is tumbling. There's been lots of instances of fraud and scams coming out of the UK. There is absolutely missing in anything. You need a trusted partner. You can't just see an advert on a social media platform and think, oh great, I'm only here. People need to be smart. They need to be savvy, just like any investment. But with that being said, there are some wonderful bottles that are very limited, very scarce, come and go quite quickly, and there's a demand for them. And so once they're sold out, the demand hasn't been satiated, and it immediately means that the price of that bottle then on the secondary market is worth more. So, that's been happening. It has become much more commonplace. The Knight Frank Index listed whiskey, they added a whiskey index, which I think internationally brought non-whiskey drinkers' attention to the fact that there is, let's say, quote-unquote, money to be made on buying whiskey. But again, I think if you don't have an interest in whiskey, if you don't have an appreciation for whiskey, you're on the back foot. You need to know what you're buying. You need to, at the very least, if it's not worth more, hopefully you can drink and enjoy it. And if you don't have the palate for it, that would be a shame.
Well, you've certainly whetted our palate for the Only Whiskey Show. Mark Pendlebury, very quickly, when and where?
It is happening in Johannesburg on the 7th and 8th of August and Cape Town on the 14th and 15th of August. Tickets are available at whiskeybrother.com.
Founder and Managing Director of Whiskey Brother. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And I'm going to say cheers, and that's where we will leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.